I'm interviewing Dr. Ronald Cannon. Dr. Cannon, you know that I have a tape recorder on.
I do.
Great, thank you.
Are you okay?
I'm okay, I can balance it here. I'd like to begin by asking you what your research focus was prior to working on transgenics.
So, I came into a program that had more or less was using or attempting to use transgenics to just to see if they could, what their utility was, just to see if they could be used for in toxicology or in what types of screens.
Mm-hmm.
And I came into this institute in 91-92. So prior, and that was about the year 89 to 91, was about when these transgenics were starting to find some utility or potential. Prior to that, I actually was working with EPA in identifying or looking for molecules that might cause germline stress in male germline. That is, would acrylamide do something to sperm cells or to cells before they, premature sperm cells that might give you an inheritance problem, a defect, a birth defect, and so we're using a mouse model there. But as far as transgenics, I came over just about the time, I was a molecular biologist by trade, knew how to clone genes, how to express genes, how to characterize expression, and knew a lot about animals. I'd worked with viruses, so I knew promoters and gene expression. Had done all that work and are in that area. And so now they have a transgenic that comes in, or a couple of transgenics that come in, and they don't know anything about them. So they recognize that they needed a good molecular biologist to come in and look at expression patterns, to characterize it at a molecular level. Where is the transgene that they've made in this transgenic? Where is it integrated? What is it doing?
Mm-hmm.
And does it have any nuances or in expression or anything like that that needs to be looked at? So that's when I came in. I came in as the toxicologists were saying, can we use these animals to identify a carcinogen or a toxic molecule, and how can we? And at the same time, while we're looking at that in toxicology areas, we need a molecular biologist, someone who actually can look at the DNA level, the protein level, at the molecular level, and characterize what's going on in these animals so that the two can complement and we can get what's called mechanistic understanding, exactly how does this thing work from the bolts up. Okay, it's not just satisfactory to know a car runs. You have to have somebody, a mechanic, that actually knows every piece of it and how it was put together and how it functions. Okay.
What made you excited about doing this research, or interested in doing this research?
Well, it was nice to get back to a program, in my opinion, that was more in vivo. It has almost immediate application significance, because transgenics are, first remember, mouse models are nothing but models, and they will always be just models for human health, so they have their shortcomings. But it was good to get to an in vivo model that might have direct, what we call translational science. It translates immediately into some human health or significance to human health.
Mm-hmm.
That was nice. At the same time, as a molecular biologist, sometimes you're abstract. You're dealing with liquids and things and test tubes that you can't see, you can only measure, or you have to see them in a special way. You have to use a fluorescent probe or something like that. So, but still, to get closer to human health, the significance in human health. I had a couple of weeks ago, and that was my sister.
Sorry.
We're trying to deal with the specter and both mental and everything else that we're dealing with. So that's what we're dealing with. So. To take that one. Okay. So what was exciting was to do something I think was that had strong significance to human health. At the same time, it's a challenge because you're dealing with molecular characterizations of mechanisms, in vivo mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different than just looking at cells, or to, as a reductionist, we kind of take things apart and ask for it to work as a complex in vitro. Mm-hmm. Here, really wanted a strong in vivo understanding of, mm-hmm. of how a mechanism works, and mm-hmm. that's what transgenics do for you, really.
Mm-hmm. How do they do that?
Well, it's you alter. If you take a distributor off of a car, it doesn't run, and you can look and see what parts, what systems don't operate. If you remove the compressor of your air conditioner, mm-hmm. the car will run, but you'll have problems. Mm-hmm. Same way with a transgenic. You can take a piece out and ask, is that a normal animal? Well, yeah, it's normal until we stress it a certain way. Mm-hmm. The analogy being until it gets hot and you need your air conditioner, you don't know your air conditioner's broken. Well, the mouse has got the same situation. In transgenics or in knockouts, you can alter. Alter one little component. Alter one little component and then test it. I'm sorry. How can you do that in vivo? And why are they nice? I think that was the last thing. Is basically, you can alter very specific pathways or biological processes or processes. And see their effect. Mm-hmm. You can, if you know a lot about stress or chemicals or responses, you can lower thresholds. Mm-hmm. That is, you can make an animal more sensitive mm-hmm. to a particular process or stress or chemical. And that's kind of exciting because you get to test your hypothesis. We believe that this pathway, if it signals through a certain way and when dosed with chemical X at a certain rate, that at some frequency it will produce a tumor. Well, you can increase that rate and watch your tumorigenesis, your ability to make tumors go up, or you can knock the whole pathway out and completely wipe it out, and then if it can't signal through that pathway, if molecules can't interact to send a signal and cause gene expression changes in the nucleus, then you may not get tumorigenesis. Mm-hmm. So you can have models and hypotheses and actually test it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty exciting because there's not many systems where you actually can go in, mm-hmm. you know, with a molecular laser and actually change a pathway, change its rate, change its sensitivity or its ability to do something, or to completely ablate it, completely mm-hmm. knock it out, and look at the effect in vivo in a living animal. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen very often.
Which were the first of the transgenic models you worked with?
Probably the first that came through was the TGAC that I was. The TGAC had just come into the institute, and I was basically called over to find out what in the heck's going on with this animal. And that was. But at the same time, or just after that, the P53 came in, mm-hmm. and we looked at that one. We looked at that one more in collaboration with Jeff Finch. Are you speaking with Jeff?
Yeah, that's yesterday.
Jeff. So that's Jeff's package there. He mm-hmm. worked with the makers of that, whereas we kind of separated that. However, we saw utility in both, and we've worked together. So mm-hmm. we're all kind of, at that time, we were just a family with a lot of presence, and it was just, mm-hmm. it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
You said that the models came into the institute. How did they come in?
Okay, so I look at it as they came into the institute. That's not an appropriate statement. There was a lot of hard work and a lot of road paving and a lot of bumps that were removed. And Ray Tennant would probably be able to give you some of that. So there were collaborative efforts along the way to make a better mousetrap. Here we have what's called a National Toxicology Program that has for years and years trying to develop and validate and evolve assay systems in vivo, live good models that can identify hazardous chemicals so that we can keep those chemicals from getting out in the environment, and also pharmaceuticals, a lot of problems there, a lot of different drugs. And it was real obvious that we couldn't meet, and still can't meet the need. We could not meet the need. In other words, thousands of chemicals, chemists are making up new derivatives every day. Mm-hmm. They're finding utility in making synthetics, also additives, you name it, that's all over the place. And we can't test them. Mm-hmm. It's a 2-year bioassay. We cannot test. The time does not allow you to test. So you're stuck. What are you going to do with these molecules? What are you going to do with these chemicals? So the invention was necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. So Ray recognized early on, along with some other people. Dr. Tennant recognized along with some other people, and I think Ken Olden was instrumental in supporting at least the cause. And no one knows. It's research. You don't know whether it's going to work out. So we were looking for Ray was looking for models, and you don't just go to the shelf and get one. You go to your basic researchers, and at the time, Phil Leader, I think Ray had kind of gotten a close collaborative interaction with Phil Leader at Harvard. Have you interviewed Phil?
Not yet.
Okay, I would urge you to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And Aya, too, for that matter.
Sorry, what was the
second? His wife, Aya Leader. Phil and Aya. And they have a PNAS paper, which is the original paper on TGAC. It's a 91 paper, I think. 90 or 91 paper. So they had cornered the market, I guess, on the technique of making these transgenics, and then even got a patent, which is off the record, still, you know, it bothers some people. Mm-hmm. On the record, it's just reality, the Oncomouse patent.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they had worked this, they had refined these technologies and were making mice, and I think they weren't making them specifically for us, but these transgenics were coming around and they were evaluating their utility in the identification of toxic or carcinogenic
mm-hmm.
chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And so some worked and some had some efficacy
mm-hmm.
and some did not. And TGAC was almost a serendipitous finding. It turned out to be an interesting one with potential.
Mm-hmm.
And the P53, I don't know what year it was Molecule of the Year. It's like the mm-hmm. gatekeeper of the genome. I think Jeff probably would have give you a better background on it. But that was a real obvious one. I have an old friend named Jed Spaulding, if you get a chance to talk to him. I don't mean old. I mean our friendship has been a long time. And he likes to say there's bricks and there's bricklayers.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to regulate something, you need to alter the bricklayers.
Mm-hmm.
Not the bricks. The bricks are what they put up. In other words, there are, and Ray likes to think of it as networks and hubs. If you want to alter something, you want to alter the hub, which will affect all the spokes in the entire network.
Mm-hmm.
P53 was clearly a hub. It was mm-hmm. something that would regulate a multitude of genes and processes that deal with DNA damage, toxicity, carcinogenicity.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly a tumor suppressor gene, and mm-hmm. I think it was one of the first.
And what is TGAC?
Okay, so back to the car analogy. I don't know how we got on this, but if you think about cancer, which is what these models are basically in cancer, carcinogenic potential or identifiers of chemicals that cause cancer. You essentially have two things that happen. A cell is just a cancer is just a cell that has lost the ability to differentiate, that is turn into something that it was supposed to be. For example, there are cells in your hair follicle that divide a few times and then become your epidermis of your skin. Okay, so it has the ability to proliferate, to divide unchecked. Okay, a normal cell would divide and stop after a few divisions and turn or differentiate into whatever tissue it's supposed to. So there are a set of genes that we call proliferative genes
mm-hmm.
that drive the proliferative process. Those are analogous to the accelerator. They make your car go.
Okay.
There are also a set of genes that are brakes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that say you have become what you're supposed to become at this point in time at the right location. You stop now.
Mm-hmm.
And those are in the class of, and they also cause cells to die, not only to differentiate, but to live a certain length of time and die. So if you can, so to get cancer, essentially you have to have the gas on, and and some problem with the brake, because if you proliferate and you proliferate too much, you can still differentiate and die, and that would be something like psoriasis in skin. You would have a hyperproliferative disease which might thicken your skin or redden your skin, but it would still differentiate and you wouldn't have a tumor. But if you lost the brake, that is, if you lost the ability to turn into a skin cell and you just proliferated, then you would go not only just unchecked division, but you wouldn't be differentiating into a tissue and you would become cancerous.
Okay.
And then that would give you the ability potentially to metastasize, because you now don't differentiate. You stay at a very undifferentiated state, mm-hmm. and you're able to now live in places other than maybe skin or pancreas or kidney or what have you, and now you can move around and still find nutrients and grow. So now you become an very undifferentiated, anaplastic is another word, aggressive metastatic tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires you to lose both, to increase the acceleration, and RAS, TGAC, has a gene that is a class of a proliferator.
Okay.
So what, in a sense, what you have to do, they've known for many, many years, about 30% of all human tumors have been linked to one of this particular class of proliferator genes called RAS, R-A-S.
Okay.
And those genes, normally they're kind of like an on-off switch. Most cells use RAS to hit the accelerator to divide, and then immediately just and off.
Mm-hmm.
So divide and stop, divide and stop. So mutations in RAS basically don't allow, it's like the accelerator cable's been cut, you're wide open. And it's a molecular event that causes it to be what we call constitutively activated, is the term, which means that it's on all the time, can't turn it off. So now you're left with just how good is your brake. So these transgenics, the TGAC has a RAS gene that is off. It's mutated, but it's turned off. So the animal develops normally, and then the gene is turned on, and when it expresses that gene, it expresses it constitutively. The protein is modified where it constantly sends a proliferative signal, i.e. the accelerator is pushed to the floor. And now it's a question, can you stop it?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, will the brake work?
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, for a short period of time, the brake works, just mm-hmm. like in a normal car if you had the accelerator. But eventually, some genetic event occurs that hits a second gene, and your brake is gone, and now you're in full-fledged tumors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, that's known, so it's almost like for any chemical to give you a cancer, or for you either have to have a genetic problem that you're born with where one of the genes is already hit,
mm-hmm.
and you need to some chemical, or just through aging process or metabolic process, is just going through normal life, a second gene is hit. In other words, that is, you've got now a multiple hit, so you have some compromise in the ability to stop proliferation or to differentiate. And so in designing of TGAC, they were actually looking for a stem cell leukemia. It didn't have anything to do with skin. The leaders, and this is why you should interview the leaders, were the first to look at the hemoglobin genes, which had to do with blood, and they also had their hands on the RAS gene, the mutated form of the RAS gene. It's actually a virus uses it. And so they stole the gene from the virus and put it in a transgenic, put a promoter that had something to do with hemoglobin, alpha hemoglobin, you have two subunits of hemoglobin, and asked for this hemoglobin to be, they chose a hemoglobin that expressed very, very early in what we call stem cells, or very early undifferentiated cells, hoping that it would turn on, the promoter is the thing that regulates when it's on and off. It would turn on this RAS in a early blood cell, and that you would turn, this would proliferate unchecked and give you leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does do that. TGAC does do that. in about a third of the animals, but it takes a year out before it shows mm-hmm. up. And what was weird, and this again, you need to go to the leaders to get this straight from them, but they made the transgenic looking for leukemia, and they housed these mice, and they had quite a few of them. These are all transgenics. And the mice groom, and sometimes over groom, they scratch themselves. Mice also are dominant, even some females can be dominant, but especially males. And if you group house mice, mm-hmm. they will bite each other. Mm-hmm. And so they were some of them were group housed, and some of them over groomed, and some of them just nipped each other. And Aya, who was managing, this is Phil's wife, who was managing these colonies of mice, noticed that where they bit mm-hmm. and wounded each other, they were getting tumors.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a bank of literature, there's a bulk of literature, starting with Arduous and Rodbell and Slega, and way back years ago, that defined this double hit theory, where you needed two things, a gene and then proliferate to get tumors. And they knew that it was a RAS gene that had been identified, and they also knew that wounding was a process to cause tumorigenesis to occur. There's a model of tumorigenesis called two-stage skin tumorigenesis. It's been around for 40 years, and Boutwell was one of the first ones to Rod Boutwell was one of the first ones to describe this. And if you dermally treat a mouse with a carcinogen or a mutagen, it's called initiation. And what that initiating event does is turn your normal RAS gene into this type of RAS gene that they put in this mouse. Then the second component you need is something that will proliferate or push these cells that have the RAS gene out of their compartment, i.e. turn them on and force them to drive proliferation unchecked. Wounding does that because wounding brings in all of these growth factors. I know this is technical.
No, it's very helpful. Okay. And I think I'm following you.
Okay, so they bring in these growth factors, and it proliferates this initiated cell.
Mm-hmm.
And so that two-stage model of making a mutation with a chemical and then using either another chemical to cause proliferation or wounding, mm-hmm. full thickness wounding, abrading, scraping, carpet mm-hmm. burn on the back of a mouse, believe it or not, you can do a felt wheel, mm-hmm. little Dremel tool, and mm-hmm. it'll just promote out all these cells that have the mutation. They'll go unchecked, they'll select for loss of break or mm-hmm. some loss of differentiation, you'll get tumors. Aya recognized, knowing the literature, that was a RAS, that gene was a RAS, and that's the very gene she put in to get leukemia, but it was happening in skin. So mm-hmm. she went, wonder if my gene is really being expressed in there. She tested it and said, it is. Mm-hmm. Found out it was. Then they tested certain chemicals that were at the time defined as promoters. Mm-hmm. So the two-stage model is initiation, making the mutation, and promoting. I know Ray may have gone over this. And promoting out these cells that have the mutation. And she tested it in the model, and all the chemicals that would promote were positive in this model. She tested the classical ones, a couple, TPA and some other ones. And so this mouse was genetically initiated. It didn't have to have a mutation in RAS. They had placed a mutated RAS in it. RAS is off. All you have to do is give it a promoter, and it gets chemicals. Well, if getting cancer is a multi-step process, and chemicals that humans are exposed to have to hit once, twice, three times, then if you can shorten or reduce the number of hits, you essentially lower the threshold. Another way of stating it is you reduce latency. We like to talk about time to tumor or time to induction. That's called the latency. So if you can reduce latency time, you're making the animal more sensitive. But in a sense, you're recapitulating what the normal process is. It takes multiple hits. If your exposure needs two, three hits, and you've got an animal that only needs one hit or two hits, this animal will get to tumorigenesis faster. In a sense, it's more sensitive, mm-hmm. but I like to think of it as it's potentiated. Its threshold is lower, and you would know that a human that was exposed to that chemical would eventually get tumors also. And a normal mouse exposed to this chemical wouldn't normally get tumors. It's just that this is a way of shortening it. So this seemed like, on the face of it, a good model to test for carcinogens because it reduced the time. Also, since all animals in you or in me, when we're dosed with it or inadvertently hit with a chemical, it's just a few of your cells that are mutated. And so the chance of you getting cancer is remote. But in the mouse, since it's genetic, it goes through the germline, every single cell has the same mutation. So it becomes intrinsic or inherently more, if you will, homogeneous, and the fidelity of the induced response goes up. So it's more predictable in a sense that if you use standard chemicals that would normally give you a tumorigenic response, it'll always give you one in TGAC, or should. There were some instances where some instability came about, but you don't want to know about that. That's off the record.
Okay.
We solved that. There's always problems with models, and there were some situations where at first people were trying to validate them, and it took a while to standardize the protocol.
Mm-hmm. What work was required in order? How does a protocol become standardized?
That's a tough one. We used to call it the V word, validation.
Mm-hmm.
It basically, you have to know the animal and know the process, the biological process, well enough to where you know that it's reasonable based on your historical and all of your experience. Mm-hmm. It's not reasonable to dose an animal at a dose with so high that you completely wipe the skin off or cause a wounding or kill the animals or what have you. And so toxicology has defined maximum tolerated dose and no effect levels, and there's an experimental paradigm that's been in place based on a previous assay, the two-year bioassay.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just a shortening, less animals, and a modified two-year bioassay, if you will, using a genetic model, alternative models is what they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And these alternative models somehow have been genetically modified to either reduce latency, lower threshold, but do it in an acceptable, understood mechanistically or biologically mm-hmm. relevant way.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that these pathways are the ones that are important. We know that these genes are the ones that are mutated or overexpressed in the normal tumorigenic response. So let's go ahead and predispose the animal to that and see if that chemical will find that altered pathway and exploit it
mm-hmm.
and do it in a shorter period of time. That allows us to test more chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to know something mechanistically. Now you know what pathway it tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to, there's been a debate whether it's actually cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we can say that it probably has cut costs, but getting back to your question, to validate this assay, you have to test a lot of chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've tested a lot of chemicals, and we've published a lot of papers on it, and we've gone to a lot of meetings, and there was an international harmonization committee that was put together. There was ILSI,
mm-hmm.
International
Life Sciences,
right. So all of these people, there were consortiums that were put together to come in and contribute to it. Do you like these models? If you don't believe in them, will you give what should we do? Give us a list of chemicals. So they all devised all these protocols, and they standardized it. Basically, all came to an agreement, and then they contributed chemicals from there. I mean, I think it's unheard of, unprecedented, where all these companies came together and said, I'll let you try this chemical, you try this chemical, and all these companies that had been competing,
mm-hmm.
although they knew each other, and you know, all the pharmaceuticals know each other to a certain extent, they contributed, and we tested against a bank of transgenics. Mm-hmm. There was quite a few transgenics. I mean, there was the there was one that goes through a DNA repair process, the XPA mouse. There's a RAS-H2, get some water here, from Japan that is just now becoming readily available in the U.S. There's the TGAC. Larry Donhauer and Alan Bradley had made the P53, so there's at least four, possibly five. I'm probably leaving one out. I think there was a P53 XPA cross where they put both of those in the same background. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of these, and they wanted to see how they would do. And I think there were some. There were a lot of people on the fence. There were some people that liked the old model because they knew how to get their drugs through. They knew all the pitfalls. They knew what to look for. And let's face it, no one really likes change, especially if it impinges on your ability to get a drug to market or to do something that, you know, your enterprise or anything that might affect the bringing money. Mm-hmm. It's all about money when you talk about some of these when you're testing through the pharmaceuticals. So that's basically how it was standardized. It all got together, we tested it, everybody, then we came back and we presented the data and had an agreement on protocol with all of the commercial companies and pharmaceuticals, regulators, everybody was there. Mm-hmm. And they were slowly tested through the regulators. I think Joe DeGeorge would be a good person to talk to. Frank Sestero would be a good person to talk to. They had a lot of courage. It took a lot of courage for, I think, those regulators to say, you know, instead of doing a 2-year bioassay in the mouse, you can use one of these alternative models. Mm-hmm. If you'll still use a rat 2-year, because right now, to get a chemical, or prior to this, to get a chemical through, you had to have a bank of a test that said that your chemical would not cause a genetic effect. Mm-hmm. Then you had to put it through the rat as an in vivo 2-year and a mouse 2-year. Mm-hmm. So they basically said, you know, the rat's probably enough. Let's use the alternatives to truncate the time, and maybe we can get to market and test these chemicals faster by using an adjunct or a replacement. And they've done so. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. You'll have to ask the regulator how it's faring right now. I don't know the answer to that.
One thing that I notice when I ask about which people in the regulatory agencies you all have worked with around the transgenic assays is that they're all at FDA. And I'm still trying to puzzle through what happened with EPA.
Yeah, that's I'm not backing away from it. I think that I'm trying to think of who could give you that answer. I don't know how and why. You would think that everybody would have jumped on board equally. Mm-hmm. But there was some reason I don't know the split or the difference between those two regulatory bodies. I'm sure it's, and this is probably off the record, but it's probably more politics. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why. I don't know why. That's a good question. I think part of the, well, I can give you one. Now, let me, if I think about this, this might make sense. It took years for a person, for a scientist to try to figure out when you get an effect, when you get a chemical that causes a toxic response or a tumorigenic response or any phenotype, any pathology that might come out. EPA is in the business of regulating that exposure. Mm-hmm. So EPA has spent years, along with other scientists, to try to extrapolate risk to humans from exposure to mouse models. Mm-hmm. Now remember, I told you, it's only a model. Humans don't line up to be exposed to bad chemicals, right? So do the best you can. It's not a perfect science, but they had got very good at it using two-year bioassay data. Mm-hmm. Now you have someone that says, we're going to try to just take the two-year out and use an alternative model. And it's short, and it's predisposed to tweak a certain pathway. And so if you get tumors, it's a carcinogen. Mm-hmm. Well, that's fine for just a yes, no, will it cause a problem or not? But that's not very good for a person who's used to taking all of these parameters in a very extensive, intense, comprehensive two-year bioassay and look at everything and then use mathematical formulas to extrapolate risk and what's a no effect, where can we tolerate exposures. It's just not a good situation. No one likes to be exposed to arsenic at any level. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, it's a matter of dose. Mm-hmm. Okay, there are doses that should have no effect. And so calculating that was EPA, I assume. You'll have to talk with somebody from EPA, but I would guess, my guess is that EPA thought that was an impossible thing to do with mm-hmm. alternative models. Okay. Therefore, we're not going to use pesticides in alternative mm-hmm. testing, because if a pesticide comes up positive, we can't tell you at what level we will accept pesticides in the pond or in the drinking water. Mm-hmm. Since they couldn't do the math, or mm-hmm. I shouldn't put it that way, since the math, there was just no validated or form of extrapolating risk mm-hmm. from the alternative, they'd rather stay with the 2 years, so they were not about to jeopardize all of the work that they had done so that they could mm-hmm. regulate the exposures. That's probably it. Okay. And because of that, politics likely developed. I wouldn't want that in there, but I'm guessing that there are personalities involved that mm-hmm. rather than having an open mind and say, okay, I'm a really good mathematician, let me mm-hmm. sit down and spend the next year trying to figure out what's the best way that we can use these new models and extrapolate risk, it's a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. And that's tough. Mm-hmm. If you're really good at something, if I ask you to go into a lab now and do research, you'd mm-hmm. probably say, no, I'm a writer.
Right.
And so, you know, but I'm going to say, no, you need to go in. You're going to resist that.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Speaking of new paradigms, what kind of retooling or restructuring, if any, had to occur in your lab or in the labs in which you were working in order to do research on transgenics?
It wasn't mm-hmm. that big of a difference. For people that were used to studying in the 2 year for dosing mice and having a 2 year bioassay, there were a whole set of toxicologists, pathologists that would look at these tissues. The 2 year the transgenics now said, well, you know, we have predisposed certain organ systems, certain tissues, certain cell types to be sensitive to this chemical, so we don't even think you need to look elsewhere. Mm-hmm. We basically are saying that if this animal is going to get a cancer, we've set up a pathway where it should happen on the skin mm-hmm. or in the stomach or in the lung or organ specific mm-hmm. almost. And so there's no need really to look to have, you know, 20 people in it to take an extended period of time to look at this. You should be able to look at it fast. So it was more of it's coming from my home. That's the concept, and this is not changing in the lab, but just you maybe don't need to look at tissues, all the tissues in a certain way. For example, we've set the TGAC up where if you dermally treat with a carcinogen, you get tumors on the back of the skin. Mm-hmm. Ray has called that a reporter phenotype, mm-hmm. meaning it reports out on the skin what if it's a carcinogen or not, because the mouse is staged to or predisposed, or a threshold is lower so that it will happen in the skin if you give it that drug. Well, for a pathologist, he's wanting to know, well, wait a minute, you dose it, it goes through the skin, it goes to the liver, goes to the kidney, goes to the brain, goes to the heart, goes to the lung, so there's a big problem there, because he's wanting to know what the toxic effects are on all the organs, and we're telling him, don't worry about it. If it's a carcinogen, we've set up a molecular pathway that will fire off on the skin, and you can look at it right there if it's a carcinogen. Now, if you want to know if it's toxic to the liver and all that, that's fine, but as far as its carcinogenic or oncogenic potential, the transgenic has been staged genetically to fire off in that particular organ. That takes a paradigm shift for somebody that spent their whole life studying all those organs and the effects in all those, and integrating all that into a nice story. Well, it gives this kind of problem in the kidney and liver, and we understand that that's a systemic effect, and we're saying, don't even look at that anymore. Mm-hmm. Forget that. Mm-hmm. I think we should pay more attention to them, and I think we should meet somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. I think it's not a clear-cut thing to say that it's only going to happen in a particular organ or skin, and I think maybe we don't have to look at everything, you know, as comprehensive as we had mm-hmm. in the past. That some of the transgenics should allow you to refine your looks.
Mm-hmm. I should have asked you this question earlier on. Which laboratory were you working in at when you arrived at NIH?
It was called the Laboratory of Environmental Carcinogenesis and Mutagenesis, LECM. I was in a gene tox lab at EPA mm-hmm. where we were studying certain molecules that cause toxic effects and trying mm-hmm. to come up with assays that would help you determine that. Mm-hmm. Here it was LECM, Laboratory of Environmental Carcinogenesis and Mutagenesis mm-hmm. under Ray Tennant. Mm-hmm. And Ray was bringing in transgenics and saying, will this one work? I don't know. Will this one work? Is it too sensitive? And the TGAC came in, and we immediately recognized that it had potential. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, we started doing molecular work, trying to understand, okay, why does this thing work the way it works? Mm-hmm. And so that has been my job, is to figure out basically, why does it work? How does it work the way it works? Since it doesn't work the way it was originally planned, it's not a leukemia model, although it probably could be, and it's been we published on it, but how does it, what's the mechanism, and just how does it work? And because it was a serendipitous, and it's, if you will, a enigma, it wasn't originally designed to do what it's doing now, it's been not an easy thing, but mm-hmm. it's been fun. It's a puzzle. Mm-hmm. It's a true puzzle.
Do you feel like you've solved that puzzle yet?
Oh no, I don't think we feel like we know, we obviously know quite a bit about it, but we still, to nail it to a true molecular mechanism of how the animal works has still evaded us, I mm-hmm. guess I should say. But we're getting much closer.
So, in regards to the TGAC mouse, research on the molecular mechanism has proceeded alongside research on its potential as a bioassay. Is that correct?
That's probably not a fair... The problem with molecular, it starts at the same time, but it's much easier mm-hmm. to empirically determine whether an in vivo model is acting the way it should act, that is, or consistent with a hypothesis. That is to say, to go in and clone a gene or to characterize something at the molecular level will take 5, 8, 10 years maybe. It depends on what you want to do, what you need to do. Dosing the animal, if you have 3, 4, 5, 10 commercial companies involved, 2 or 3 contract companies involved, you certainly could divvy out the animals, choose chemicals, judiciously choose chemicals. Chemicals that should give you a positive, should give you a negative. That is that. So you can know chemicals, so you can test it, and just look for just the empirical results, just empirical observations. And what was found is that the animal behaved quite well. It could discriminate between carcinogens and non-carcinogens. So presented with that data, even in the absence of molecular understanding, the regulators said this animal, and also there's a need, there's a niche. This animal identifies carcinogens that don't necessarily mutate genes.
I was going to ask you about
that. It's a non-genotoxic. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that was discovered, and Ray was instrumental in this discovery, is that, again, there's a two-stage. There's things that mutate genes, but there's also things that just proliferate out genes that have been genetically altered or mutated, cells that contain genes that have been mutated. And that proliferative component is important. You need that. And without it, you don't get the cancer. There are chemicals that do that, and those are called non-genotoxic carcinogens. So TGAC's niche was is that prior to it, there was no way to identify a non-genotoxic carcinogen. Now, some people call those promoters, based on the two-stage model, initiation and promotion.
And that two-stage model is still dominant, right?
That two-stage model has been here for 40 years and is still being investigated. If you'll look up, I'm sure if we did a Medline search, just initiation, promotion, mm-hmm. or two-stage model, you would find paper after paper after paper. Because there are multiple genes that control promotion.
Okay,
so the need for an in vivo model to identify non-genotoxic carcinogens, and the fact that there were 20, 30 chemicals that were already known, that have been well characterized through the two-year bioassay, some of which, you know, may have been called a positive, some of which may have been called a negative, but when they went through TGAC, some people looked at it like maybe TGAC gave them a wrong response. Other people said, you know, I didn't think that was a real positive in the two-year bioassay, and TGAC didn't fire off, didn't give you tumors. So that kind of makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a good report card, basically. It was at least as good as or better than what people expected, and the regulators. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing, and we know there's a lot of papers out there, and we've done quite well explaining it. Mm-hmm. But there's still some unknowns, and rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're having fun.
Good.
Job security. That's
important.
That's important. Yeah.
I'm curious about the process of bringing a molecular focus or mechanistic focus into toxicology, and what that process has been like for you.
I think for most toxicologists, it's been a welcome change.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all scientists, and we all want to know basically how things work.
Mm-hmm.
That's we're just curious. And we like to solve puzzles. That's what scientists do. We think we have the answer. That means we hypothesize. And then we go out there and try to put the puzzle together, and we say, nope, we don't have the answer. And we do it again, and that's why they call it research, right? Not just search and find, it's research. So we do it over and over until we get it right, and then we alter our hypothesis. And say, we see there, that's the way it works. So toxicologists are good scientists. But there had been, and I think unrightly so, a characterization about toxicologists that they were less mechanistic and more
phenomenological.
Yeah, phenomenological, observational. They just looked at things,
mm-hmm.
and using and watch the dynamics of change and patterns and observed phenomena and characterized it as such. It's not. I think that's an unfair rub. I think it would. I don't think that's necessarily true. So, knowing, but some people thought that nevertheless. Okay. So now with the influx of the molecular tools, there were a lot of toxicologists that really supported that because it moved them over in a molecular, more mainstream, if you will, more acceptable. And, you know, there's always been a molecular push ever since. The biochemists have been telling us that for years, but then the molecular biologists came through and they got real arrogant and acted like they knew everything, and no one knew anything. And then now we find out that molecular biologists really need biochemistry, and it's all, then it was microarray, and we still need biochemists. So it's the biochemists that are the, and I'm going to have some water, but the biochemists are basically the true molecular biologists and the mechanistic people. And we're all moving back to that. Everybody is moving. I mean, you have to admit that. That's the way I feel.
Do you want to stop and get some water?
Yeah. These are some of the
These
nucleic acids, these methods in entomology. So this is all biochemistry. But molecular evolution of nucleic acids, recombinant DNA. This was in the late 70s. All of these are biochemical protocols to do molecular biology. So this was when the biochemists started learning how to manage DNA and RNA, this transition when in late 60s and 70s. And this is when the next generation of scientists strictly worked at sequencing DNA and cloning DNA, and it was all DNA and DNA and RNA and DNA and then expressing. And that branch of science became known as molecular biologists. When really, the hardcore biochemists provided them with all their tools. And I'll be, would you like some?
You I'm good, thank
anything?
You.
Sure.
And when you were talking about the leaders, that there had been some contention around the patenting, I'm wondering if that affected your access to the TGAC mouse in any way.
It didn't affect our access because we were in the front side of the development, and not necessarily design, but just the characterization and assessing the utility of the mouse. So there were agreements, I assume, and you'd have to speak with Ray on this, there were agreements that were made with the government and or with our laboratory and other laboratories that allowed us and the government and basic researchers, I think, to get these animals early on to use them. As long as they weren't used for commercial purposes. So for basic research, it's no problem because you could get them, and you still get them. Now, the problem is that for pharmaceutical, for commercial use, where you're actually screening for tumorigenic, carcinogenic potential, testing these, you know, using for regulation purposes, regulatory purposes, they're expensive. They're $300 a mouse. $300 a mouse. And some of these mice are more than that when they come from Japan because there's other things that I know, I think the RAS-H2, I think you have to double check this, but I think that mouse is $500 a mouse. So, you know, you're using three dose groups, 20 males, 20 females, control groups. So you're looking at 3, 4, 5 times 20, 100, 200, sometimes you might double that. You're looking at 200 mice, 200 times 250 times 300 or something like that, or times 500. That can be a problem, or that's expensive. So and that is what the mouse is commercially. So there are, now that it's sold by the vendors, or a vendor.
Taconic.
Taconic, yeah. some basic researchers, when they look at that mouse and they say, I can't afford it, because they're on grant money. But off the record, this is off the record, if they really want to do their work, they could probably call Field Leader and say, we have a good basic research question. Mm-hmm. We would like to be able to obtain these mice. And he would likely call us and say, hey Ron, Jeff over here at UNC wants to do a study. Can you guys order some mice and have them shipped over there for him? And we wouldn't ask for an authorship or anything unless they needed help and really wanted to pull us in. And we would work something out where they could get their mice. Mm-hmm. Well, we might not be able to get them 1,000 mice, mm-hmm. but we could certainly get them enough mice to do the basic research, mm-hmm. as long as it's not long-term, if they're going to do 10 years of work, mm-hmm. then they need to work it out. And if they need to cross them with certain mice, the leaders have set up where if it's for basic research, it's mm-hmm. not a problem. Mm-hmm. So for basic researchers, it should not be a mm-hmm. problem. For commercial, I can see where that's a problem. But you have to also understand that commercial people can cut, the commercial companies and divisions, research and drug development areas can cut their time to market, mm-hmm. And that reduced time is money, substantial amount of money. Okay. So in most cases it's rewarding, mm-hmm. They can absorb the cost, mm-hmm. when they look at the time they save. And that's, you know, it's a case by case basis, and they need to see if that a transgenic that might be only a 26 week instead of a 52 week, or excuse me, instead of a 2 year, would work for them.
I'm curious about your opinion as to why so much of the TGAC research has been done here at NIHS. What is it about the NIHS that made this the right place for that?
The initial characterization of the TGAC mouse and of other mice, I think the new mouse, which was another oncogene.
Mm-hmm. And that's NEU, right?
Yeah, that's NEU, and it's mouse mammary tumor virus, I think, mm-hmm. was where that came from. Was an earlier one that didn't work out, mm-hmm. but because of the relationship, I think you can put this in, and you'd have to ask Ray, because I wasn't here when the early work, the new work was occurred prior to me coming here. But I think that relationship, just fostered an exchange of information, and also there was
the relationship between
Ray Tennant and I think Leader. There was this Ray's a frontier in toxicology. Mm-hmm. He's looking for new methods, groundbreaking methods that will get you good mechanistic understanding. Less time, less money, less animals, no animals if you can get there. And he was willing to take the risk. And he knew that Phil, who was one of the earlier pioneers in transgenics, had potential models. So as those models came out, you test them. And Ray was testing them, and he had a group of people, which was kind of a set-aside of the NTP, saying, NTP has the standard. National Toxicology Program is testing by a 2-year bioassay. Here's a group of people that are looking at alternatives. Mm-hmm. And that relationship allowed them to test in this genetically altered models. Some worked, some did not work. The first ones didn't. Then we came to TGAC and it did. Now, as you grab hold of something that says, hey, this feels good, this may make it, you can't give it out because it's not even characterized well enough to say what it's going to do. So you have to more or less say, okay, we have the group of people that have been testing alternative models. Let's put a lot of resources mm-hmm. in it and see if it's going to work. And so we have all the chemicals. The National Toxicology Program is here. Mm-hmm. So you have all these chemicals. You have all these pathologists, probably the highest concentration of pathologists in the world, mm-hmm. right here in this building. They can look at all the tissues and look at these mice. So it's pretty obvious that this was the place for it to happen, given the relationship and the early exchange mm-hmm. of the models between Tennant and Leader. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Tennant's now focused to a great degree on toxicogenomics. Is the transgenics research related to that in any way, or are these two separate trajectories that kind of move in their own path?
So again, I think Ray's a frontier. I think that mm-hmm. he's looking forward and trying to find assays that will move and benefit toxicology. Mm-hmm. And the microarray shows a lot of promise. Mm-hmm. It allows you to look at a lot of things all at once. What's interesting is that as you try to understand, remember now, a transgenic is nothing but an inbred strain of mouse that has one area tweaked a specific way, modified, compromised, or deleted, or amplified. Either one, any or all of those could occur in a transgenic. So if you want to know about what's happened to that transgenic, so you can interface the microarray, which looks at all the genes mm-hmm. in a normal mouse mm-hmm. and all the genes in a transgenic mm-hmm. and compares them immediately or just instantaneously, in a sense, give you a direct comparison between the genetically altered and the wild type. And it will tell you about the interrelationships, the networking, the crosstalk, of the biological activity, the relevant biological activity. As the animal sits in homeostasis, as the animal is dosed, as the animal is going to a tumorigenic process, and as the animal turns on its oncogene, the accelerators to the floor, the brakes are being broken, and it's moving into a tumorigenic mm-hmm. process. So you can track mm-hmm. the genes and their abnormal expression in a wild type and in the transgenic. Mm-hmm. So he sees it as a normal mm-hmm. movement and to answer the questions that he's always wanted to answer. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. It's challenging mm-hmm. because now you're asking, you know, it was challenging to tweak one little pathway and to study that pathway. Now you're saying, okay, when we took the distributor off the car, I want to know how it affected everything. Mm-hmm. When we disconnect the brake cable, mm-hmm. what's not working? Mm-hmm. So let's track down every little wire, but let's do it in a snapshot.
Right.
So it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of technical barriers because this is not an assay that where you say, okay, we already have the assay developed. Mm-hmm. Let's just test it in the transgenics. Mm-hmm. This is an assay where, you know, we think we can. Are we going to be able to? Mm-hmm. Can't. You know, we're finding out that, you know, the ozone in the laboratory mm-hmm. may affect the efficacy of the experiment from day to day, so you have to have filters. Mm-hmm. So what time of the year, the experimenters are actually saying it rained today and we did this experiment mm-hmm. and it, you know, it either worked or didn't work, or the humidity was so mm-hmm. so all these environmental cues are affecting mm-hmm. the chemistry mm-hmm. and it's laden with chemistry and biochemistry and mood. Getting things to work exactly the same way over and over and over, repeatedly, with confidence, is not easy. It's not easy. Machines do that real well, the biological assays, biological-based assays don't do that real well. But we're getting better at it.
Just as a final question, are there significant parts of this story that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to comment on?
I think that the thing you must remember, and everybody needs to remember, about this whole area is that we're using models, we're using mouse models. So that's a problem for some people, the fact that we're using live animals, mm-hmm. but it's a model, and by definition, it's not a human.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to have problems. Even there's no such thing as a perfect model.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you have to remember that going in when you're making these animals or when you're developing or designing these animals, you have to remember it when you're studying and you're generating data from these animals, and you have to remember it just on the as you extrapolate or as you try to apply this to humans. Don't forget their models,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people do. I mean, there are a lot of people that get in arguments where the chemicals are carcinogens mm-hmm. and whether this and all this data, and you have to remember that these are rats and mice,
mm-hmm.
and they're the best we have.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think that's lost mm-hmm. with some people. There's a lot of people. This is a rapidly moving field.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of basic researchers that are involved. There's a lot of good scientists that are involved. And there's probably a lot of good models out there that just have not made it to port.
Mm-hmm.
They just, the ship hasn't come in because it takes a long time to validate mm-hmm. in this system. It takes a long time to validate models, and it takes a lot of money, and there's not many laboratories that are set up to do it.
Mm-hmm.
No, and so that's something that there's, you know, a lot of people think that there's only one or two models, or that we only pushed one or two models. You know, I think that's not true. We're not pushing or advocating any model, and I think you'll find out as we do more research that all these models have problems.
Mm-hmm.
They're all, but the 2-year bioassay had problems mm-hmm. too, and still does. It's just you have to learn to work around them. They're not perfect,
right.
The models. It's unfortunate that you can't just test all the transgenics or all the mouse models or all the rat models that are out there and immediately be able to validate them mm-hmm. and standardize it and go right into a testing and pick the best mm-hmm. one. It takes a long time,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to take a long time for the microarray too,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. So it's just a very slow process.
Mm-hmm.
These are just thoughts off the top of my head.
That's great. I was going to say, I'll be down repeatedly through the year, so...
So you'll be here.
Can I?
Yeah. There's. If you have any questions,
I'll write to you again. And
I think I don't know how the regulators would feel, but I think it took a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this now. You're in charge of determining whether that chemical goes on the market, goes into clinical trials, is put into a human being,
mm-hmm.
or more than one human being. And you have done this for years by a certain way. And now somebody's coming to you and telling you that, you know, 50% of the weight of evidence that you used to determine that, we're going to wipe that
mm-hmm.
whole assay out and put a new one in that's never been tested.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a very courageous group of people to say, I think that's a good idea. Let's try this new assay. And it can't be taken lightly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that those people were, I mean, they were sweating it.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be. So I think that would be a great, great interview to sit down with Frank Sestero, Joe DeGeorge especially, if you can, off the record, if you can really get him into a real personable state and not sit back and talk to you from a bureaucratic standpoint, but if you can get him to open up, I think it would be fun to ask him things like, just, did you ever, you know, did you ever go home at night and think, oh my Lord,
what have I done?
Is this going to work? Or what have we done? Or do you still do that? Or how do you feel? And you know, there's got to be some good questions. From a basic researcher's point of view, it's just been fun. It's a puzzle, you know. Sometimes it's a puzzle with no picture. It's a puzzle that you're working upside down and you're just trying to figure out if it fits. But it's a puzzle nonetheless. For them, though, it's a regulatory decision, and it has immense implications, ramifications, and I think that side of the story would be interesting.
I'm going to do everything I can to get it, and once I get it, it'll be in the public domain, so I'll be happy to share it with you.
All we did was, you know, we're scientists, and we just asked a lot of things. Well, how does this thing work? Well, what happens if we do that, or can we figure out what its pieces are and how to put it together and how to take it apart. And then there's another side. It basically boils down to that. The basic researchers like me are asking how's it put together? Can we take it apart, put it back together, and get it to work? People like Ray are asking, what happens if we dose it with chemicals and how does it respond? Don't care about, let somebody else worry about exactly how that's working. Will the car run? Okay. And then you have these other people, which I think is fascinating, that say, you know, we're going to use this to regulate. We're going to use this to decide whether this chemical, and that, from a basic researcher, is a tough. That's a tough position to be in. So I would like to hear what, and I haven't really ever. I know both those guys real well, but I haven't ever really. I mean, I've heard them say, well, what would you do if it had a negative gene tox and a negative rat but came up positive here, or, you know, they'd give you scenarios, and you could tell that they were anguishing. They were taking, I'm sure they took it home with them a lot. And interesting, I guess it is interesting, they're both no longer, working.
They've gone to work for pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, right. So there's a whole other story that I'm sure that shouldn't probably ever go public for years and years. But that's interesting too.
Right.
There's a sidebar there, and I'm sure, you know, it's what the market will bear. And also you can only, when you go, I wonder if it has to do with going through the. The selection and all that, all of it, to go through that process and know now that, you know, we've pretty much made it through it. We've weathered the storm, and there's not much left there. I mean, the rest of it's just kind of dealing with what you set up, and you have other choices and you choose those. But I'm sure that was a very exciting time so the last 10 years have been very exciting. Probably more so for those folks than for us. Although I don't know how that could be, because we really like, or at least most people that are in basic research and thrive on it really like what they do. We're pretty passionate about it.
Which is great. That's why I love interviewing you all. It's fun.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to turn this off.